following is a production of the Florida State University Department of Religion. On February 20th, 2015, Dr. Bruce Lincoln, the Caroline E. Haskell Distinguished Service Professor of the History of Religions in the Divinity School of the University of Chicago, gave a keynote speech at the 14th Annual Graduate Symposium of the Department of Religion at Florida State University. His talk was entitled, "A 17th Century Werewolf and the Drama of Religious Resistance." This production is copyright to the Florida State University and Dr. Bruce Lincoln. All rights reserved. The running time of this lecture is approximately 1 hour and 30 minutes.
Thanks so much. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted, you know, to be part of this occasion. Before I turn to what I think really is quite an extraordinary example, it's probably useful to say a few words about the general theme of this conference: resistance and religion. Both of those nouns have their intricacies and also their problems, and these are only compounded when you try to put the two of them together. So let me begin by specifying how I understand them, which will at least give us something to argue about afterwards. First, I take resistance to be a defensive strategy, a posture, and an operation available to subordinate parties in situations of asymmetric power, a move through which they seek to obstruct initiatives that threaten to erode their position and that threaten to exacerbate the already existing relations of domination. It can also provide a means to evade obligations that the dominant party seeks to impose on them, also to challenge, disrupt, confound disparaging constructions that are advanced by the dominant party as a means to justify their regime of domination. Resistance can and does take an almost infinite variety of forms, including, in alphabetical order, defiance, dissemblance, distraction, evasion, foot dragging, feigned ignorance, gossip, inefficiency, insolence, insubordination, irony, mimicry, mockery, nostalgia — this goes on for a while — nostalgia, parodic hypercompliance, reverie, sabotage, subversion, and countless others. Such variety is appropriate to an agonistic strategy that's designed not to prevail, not to win the struggle, but to survive and persist, ceding as little ground as possible to adversaries who are, or who at least seem to be, more powerful. Calculating whose power is truly superior, however, often proves more complicated than might initially be expected, for power comes in many forms. Some of those forms are objective, and they represent the material resources a group can commit to a struggle, things like disposable wealth, specialized manpower, technologies of surveillance and repression, to cite a few examples. But subjective factors also have their importance, insofar as these determine a group's willingness to wage a struggle and to make maximum use of whatever objective resources are at their disposal. Under the right circumstances, an inspiring story, a firm set of beliefs, strong sentiments of dedication, or an ethic of self-sacrifice can, and actually even does on occasion, count for more than demographic, economic, technological, or military advantages. One is reminded of the stories of the Christian martyrs, or more recently, of what Ho Chi Minh told the French in September of 1946 at the close of unsuccessful negotiations. Quote, "You will kill 10 of our men, but we will kill one of yours. And in the end, it is you who will tire. Now, some theorists might define Uncle Ho's faith as a religion of sorts, his own protestations and discomfort with that designation notwithstanding. And reasonable arguments, I think, are available on both sides of the question. Personally, I take a key feature of religion to be the tendency to invest human entities with more than human status. As, for instance, when a group understands itself as God's elect, or frames its laws as ancestral tradition or divine commandment. And the example of Uncle Ho is instructive here. If his confidence was based on the fact that the morale, discipline, and dedication of his troops was superior to that of the French, and later the Americans, then I think there's nothing religious in his prophecy, since all of these are human qualities. But if, on the other hand, he followed Hegel in imagining that Geist, cosmic spirit, or the divine, if you will, manifests itself in history as an irresistible trend toward ever more perfect freedom, and if he saw that Geist at work in the Vietnamese struggle for independence, then his faith takes on a religious cast. Within the dynamic of domination and resistance, religion figures, I think, as an independent variable, which is to say, it has no necessary relation to either side. Some projects of domination are framed in religious terms, as with the Chinese mandate of heaven, the American imperative of manifest destiny, the French mission civilisatrice, the Hindu caste system, the justification of slavery that was grounded in the biblical story of Noah's sons, or Zionist claims to Palestine. But a great many projects of domination have no real religious character to them. Similarly, some projects of resistance assume religious form, as in the Native American ghost dance, the independent churches of colonial Africa, the Maccabean revolt, or the struggle waged by the Nizari Ismailis against Seljuk domination. This is the group that popularly known as the Order of Assassins. There's no necessity for either side to adopt a religious coloration, although there may be some strategic or tactical benefit in doing so. For whenever and wherever religion enters struggles of this sort, it inevitably raises the stakes, since those who understand their interests, values, status, and dignity, their attachment to certain customs and traditions, their claim to privileged positions or pieces of land, as divinely ordained, mythically chartered, or inscribed in the very structure of the cosmos, and from that set of convictions, draw determination to defend them all the more fiercely. In doing so, they convince themselves that the struggle they wage is not just motivated by naked self-interest, but rather it's been recoded in ways to make it seem and feel as if foundational truths and sacred principles are really at stake. With that by way of an admittedly inadequate prologue, let me turn to the example I really want to spend most of our time discussing. This is drawn from early modern Livonia. Livonia is a territory that included what today is the Baltic Republic of Estonia and the Baltic Republic of Latvia. They were joined in the Middle Ages and into early modern period. And this was, in fact, the very last corner of Europe to be converted to Christianity. During the 16th and 17th centuries, this was also the land that was understood to be the classic home of the werewolf. Much like Transylvania is the classic home of vampires. Livonia and the Baltic is where werewolf lore, legend, fear, belief flourished most enormously. Witness, for instance, the testimony of Olaus Magnus, who was the last bishop of Catholic bishop of Sweden, in his History of the Peoples of the North, published in 1555. In Prussia, Livonia, and Lithuania, nearly all along, the inhabitants experienced no small damage from the rapacity of wolves, because a huge number of their animals are torn to pieces and eaten if they stray only a small distance from the herd in the woods. This loss, however, is not reckoned by them to be as great as that they are forced to bear from men who have turned into wolves. At night, on the feast of Christ's Nativity, a horde of wolves assembles who have changed from men that dwell in different places. After that night, with astonishing ferocity, they rage against the human species and other animals who do not have a wild nature. Truly, the inhabitants of this region receive more harm from these than from true and natural wolves. For as is known, they assault the houses of people in the woods with astounding savagery as they attempt to break down the doors so that they may eat whatever people and animals remain there. They invade beer cellars and drink some barrels of beer or mead, then pile the empty mugs in the middle of the cellar, one on top of another, in which practice they differ from natural and genuine wolves. And this is an illustration from Olaus Magnus. And you see here the band of werewolves. Perhaps a leader here, some spirit of the woods, a little village behind. They're armed, they're mounted, they're scary. And I should mention, this is I've got a lot of pictures that are, 16th and 17th century illustrations of werewolves. Some of them relate more clearly to the text I'm considering than others. This is the one with the closest relations. Some of the others are just pretty pictures. Similar is the account of Christian Courtauld, roughly a century later, in a text that bears the charming title, God's Ape, and the subtitle, Detailed Description of the Shameful Temptations of Satan, published in 1677 under the pseudonym Theophilus Sincerus, sincere God lover. Here's his text. It would not be offensive to make use of this opportunity to sketch the common, unfortunately widespread evil of the land, so abundant in the northern lands and bordering realms, especially in Courland and Livonia, whereby witches and sorcerous fiends change themselves into wolves. By night they run about to harm people, animals, and fruit of the fields, and to cause great damage. For this they are called werewolves or fear wolves. This is a pun in the German, Warwolf oder Gefahrwolf. In the morning, toward dawn, when one can observe this, they run across fields, back to their homes, villages, and dwellings, and then they take back their natural human form, carrying out their work and routines like other men, exerting themselves, eating, drinking, speaking, and living as reasonable people tend to do. Earlier werewolf picture. These stereotyped accounts establish the background for the incident that concerns me. The date is April 1691. The setting, the district court of Venden, about 88 miles northeast of Riga, which is the capital of today's Latvia. There, the trial of an accused thief, already underway, took a very unexpected turn when one of the witnesses smiled as he was asked to take the oath before testifying. Noticing his smile, the judges asked him what it was about. And he said he was amused to see that his neighbor, a man he called Old Teese, and Teese is a nickname for Matthias, he saw Old Teese sitting in the audience, also waiting to testify, and this witness said, quote, "Everyone knows Old Teese goes around with the devil, and he was a werewolf, How could he swear? Since he wouldn't lie about such things, and he's pursued them for many years. At that, the whole trial turns its attention away from the thief who's in the dock, and the judges focus their attention on old Tease. He's a man over 80, and he did, in fact, freely acknowledge his werewolf identity and his werewolf past. And in response to the judges' questions, he recounted how this had already come up at another district court just a few years before. And on that occasion, the judges laughed at the stories he told, and they dismissed him without sentence. Upon hearing that, one of the two presiding judges at the court of Venden asked whether this man was out of his mind. And the other judge, who had been his employer in the past and knew him well, vouched for his physical and his mental health, his absolute truthfulness, and the accuracy of his account. This had, in fact, happened at another court, the court of Nytown. At that, the judges entered into another line of questioning. They asked old Tease how he became a werewolf, what he did in his werewolf state. They asked the number and identity of his fellow werewolves, tried to get him to name names. They looked into his status as a Christian, and they were particularly interested in the nature of his dealings with the devil. On most of those points, Tease's answers conformed to the stereotypes in the passages that I read previously and stereotypes that the judges and others all held. Along those lines, he told them that he had gained the power of lycanthropic transformation when a stranger gave him a magical potion. And after he drank that, he was able to put off his human form and assume that of a wolf. Several times each year on ritual occasions, particularly around Christmas, he gathered with a large band of werewolves in the neighborhood. And together they stole livestock, they dismembered the animals, and they feasted on their meat. On the most important point of all, however, Tease's testimony differed sharply from the judge's expectations. Contrary to their repeated attempts to establish the diabolical nature of his associations and his actions, old Tease insisted that werewolves oppose the devil and do battle against sorcerers and witches who serve the devil. In response to hostile questions, he acknowledged that the werewolves do, in fact, enter hell every year. But he went on to explain that they go there only as what he called hounds of God, who seek to recover. The term he uses is a complicated one. He says they go to recover Zagan, which means most literally a blessing, but specifically the blessing of prosperity and fertility that comes as the result of God's grace. And it takes the form of abundant crops, rich livestock, general prosperity. That prosperity, he said, sorcerers stole. And whenever the werewolves succeeded in recovering it, stealing it back from the devil, the harvest would be good. Whenever they failed, there would be hardship and famine. In the face of Tease's testimony, the judges introduced sophisticated theological arguments, trying to show the old man the error of his ways. Didn't werewolves defy God, they explained to him, when they abandoned their human form? Because the Lord God created humans in his own image, and since it's impossible for humans to undo God's creation, didn't it follow that they didn't really change into wolves, but that it was all a diabolical delusion, and the devil was playing tricks with them, and you know, they needed to stop such nonsense, repent, and confess? When learned arguments failed to persuade the old man, The judges called in reinforcements, as the court record reflects, and the court stenographers report. The Herr pastor of this place, Magister Buchholz, was summoned and asked to attend the proceedings. He sought to urge the self-professed Segensprecher, means a speaker of blessings, a conjurer, a charlatan, a sinner who was caught in the devil's snares, persuade him to take to heart his grievous sins by which he had been led astray and in which he persisted for many years, and to stir his conscience that he might convert and repent by a rightful repentance and might make an abjuration of these devilish beings. For his part, the pastor pronounced Thies a grievous and wanton sinner, told him he was facing harsh punishment in this world, and even worse, in the next, his only chance being to confess and repent. Stunningly, in the face of the pastor's importunements, Thies announced that he understood these things better than the pastor did, since he was just a young kid anyhow. Angered at what he considered unjust and ill-founded accusations, the old man rejected characterization of his deeds as diabolical or evil. The court records, he showed himself truly obstinate and remained insistent that all he had done was no sin against God. Rather, he had done God much service thereby, in fulfillment of his will that they recover the prosperity from the devil that sorcerers had carried to him, and he did good thereby for the whole land. Such defiance placed the judges in a difficult, indeed a very awkward position. They had neither a confession, nor any physical evidence, nor any eyewitness testimony that Thies had made a compact with the devil. And all of these are the normal requirements for a conviction in a case of this sort. Given that legal difficulty, they decided, quote, they could not reach a definitive verdict on so difficult and complex a case. And making use of some complicated procedures in medieval law, they effectively kicked it upstairs to a higher court, threw up their hands, and pronounced no judgment. Since the transcript of old Thies' trial was first published in 1924, a number of distinguished scholars have devoted attention to it, as it seems to provide the best surviving evidence anywhere of a werewolf's self-understanding. Most noteworthy and most influential to date have been two studies. First, the work of Otto Hoerfler, an Austrian scholar active in the 1930s until the 1970s, who associated Thies with the cultic groups of martial males, and what he called Männerbunde, male secret societies, which he took to be characteristic of Aryan Europe. And the rival theory that emerged to refute Hoerfler of Carlo Ginzburg, the great Italian historian, who treated Thies' invasion of hell as an ecstatic journey similar to and ultimately derived from Eurasian shamanism. Subsequently, Mircea Eliade, Hans-Peter Dürr, Gabor Clanice, and Eva Pochs have all contributed to the discussion, usually following either Hoerfler or Ginzburg, and in the case of Eliade, trying to hedge his bets and have it both ways. For all that these authors differed sharply, and it really was a very, very fierce difference, in the political, moral, and religious values that they thought they could recognize in the case, almost all of them agreed on basic points of method and theory. They all viewed Livonian werewolfery as a late survival of something much, much older. And they thought these data would let them shed light on a deep pre-Christian substratum of European religiosity. And in pursuit of that, they compared details of Tisa's account to other phenomena found elsewhere that they thought were similar. For Herfler, this was particularly accounts. I'm going backwards, sorry. It's just something else. For Herfler, this was Old Norse berserkers, enraged, frenzied warriors who transform into animals. There it is. This is the earliest evidence we have. And you see, this wolf-headed warrior here. And this is from way before the conversion. And Herfler maintained that Nordic, Germanic, Aryan males cultivated ecstatic states of frenzy in which their bodily capacities, they were like mean FSU linebackers on speed, that they just went raging out of control and were unstoppable, and this is what these werewolves are like. And Thies is still 1690s, showing that these cultic groups persist. Ginsberg, for his part, was looking at healers, visionaries, shamans who danced themselves into trances, journeyed to the other world to consult with angry spirits and bring back people who are sick and dying, recover their soul when evil spirits have captured them. And Ginsberg looked, instead of to the north, he looked to the east and the south and to the west at Slavic healers and shapeshifters, witches from the Pyrenees, cult groups of northern Italy, and Siberian shamans. And their differences notwithstanding, and Herfler really was a committed Nazi, and Ginsberg is a committed socialist. But both of them thought, this datum holds something terribly ancient. You assemble it with a bunch of others, and together they let you see millennia into the past, beyond Christianity to the forms of religion that were all over Europe. Conceivably, that's possible. I wouldn't rule it out a priori. But the results of that kind of comparison are always highly speculative. And the history of that kind of endeavor gives repeated lessons in caution. For my part, I think it would be much better to follow the lead of specialists in Baltic studies who have considered this and other werewolf prosecutions in great detail. Since close examination of Thies's trial lets us recognize something very different than deep prehistory, I think what we can see in it is the dynamics of oppression and resistance, as these were theorized, rendered operational, and experienced in a religious vein in the Baltic in the 17th century. In order to appreciate that aspect of the trial, it's useful to begin by taking stock of the dramatis personae in the drama. The transcript identifies 9 individuals as officers of the court, and 2 others as religious authorities who cooperated with the court. In their order of appearance, they are Herr Assessor Bengt Johann Ackerstaff, substitute judge of the District Court of Venden, who lived in Castle Klingenberg outside Lemberg. This is the man who previously had been Thies's employer. Herr Assessor Gabriel Berger, judge of the District Court of Venden. Herr Baron Kronenstern, judge of the District Court of Nittau. Herr Rosenthal, judge of the District Court of Nittau. Herr Kaudi, judge of the District Court of Nittau. These are the ones that laughed at Thies's first hearing. Herr Richter, who has an estate in the vicinity of Sunzel. Herr Pastor of Lemberg. Herr Pastor of Jürgensburg, Magister Buchholz, whom we've met. Herr Chief Deputy Klot. Herr Assessor Martini,
and the illustrious, praiseworthy assessor of the Royal High Court, Herr Hermann Georg von Trautvetter. Note, all of these worthies receive the honorific title Herr. And with the exception of Herr Assessor Martini, all of them have German surnames. They are transparently members of the German elite, who constituted the upper stratum of Livonian society ever since the Teutonic Knights conquered the territory early in the 13th century. When Livonia later came under Swedish rule, this was 1629 to 1721, ethnic Germans continued to own the bulk of the land, just as they continued to control most of the wealth and continued to monopolize most of the clerical and political offices through which power was exercised over the indigenous peasantry. The lower stratum of the population included Latvians and Estonians who worked the land that the German overlords owned. In administrative and common parlance, the two Baltic groups were usually classed together and collectively referred to, this is the Estonians and the Latvians, collectively are referred to in all the documentations as the Undeutsche, the non-Germans, in contrast to the ruling stratum who are always referred to as the Deutsche, the Germans. Old Thies, the others who were called to testify before the court, and almost everyone that they mentioned in their testimony fell into this subordinate group. The list is as follows. The church thief of Jürgensburg, Pearson Turnus, an inhabitant of Kaltenbrunn named Old Thies, and the transcript says of him, in most obvious ways a poor man and thoroughly powerless. The Kaltenbrunn innkeeper Peter, Skestan, a peasant from Lemberg who broke Thies' nose on an earlier occasion, a peasant from Marienberg who gave his wolf pelt to a peasant from Alash, Skestan Rhein, son of the Skestan who was the nose breaker, a scoundrel from Marienberg who tricked Thies into becoming a werewolf, Tyrumen, a peasant from Zegevold, a werewolf who was particularly skilled at stealing livestock, a peasant of Rodespeich, who accompanied Thies to a tavern, a fellow from Jürgenberg, Gika Janen, stepson of the blessed Herr Pastor, whose leg Thies healed, Ilgash, a peasant from Nitau, who obtained a net, probably a piece of magical, you know, paraphernalia from Thies, and Gurion, a peasant of Jürgensberg, who had his grain blessed by Thies. All of these men came from villages in central Livonia. This area is about 15 kilometers in radius. Let's see. Kaltenbrunn here is Thies' home. Lemberg, as we'll see, is where hell is located. Venden is where the court had the hearings. And everybody mentioned is within this radius, about 15 kilometers in total. None of them bear the title Herr or any other title of dignity. Most of them are identified as peasants, 9 out of the 13. The others as innkeepers, thieves, or scoundrels. Most of them are given only a first name, and usually one that is non-German. Pearson, Skestan, Tyrumen, Gricka, Ilgash, Gurion. None of them are treated with any respect, with the exception of Gricka Janen, who is called a fellow, curl, cognate with English churl. This is slightly better than peasant, bower. And apparently he's given that name because he was adopted by, quote, the blessed Herr Pastor. The same social divide is evident in the 17 other Livonian werewolf trials for which records survive. In these, the court officials are consistently Deutsche. The defendants are always undeutsche, as are most of the witnesses and people called before the court. This is, in fact, the most important line of cleavage in the early modern Baltic. It's simultaneously ethnic, linguistic, cultural, national, and socioeconomic. It separates the elite from the popular classes, landowners from peasantry. As Stefan Doniker and others have convincingly demonstrated, religious difference plays an extremely important role in legitimating the hierarchic line of divide. Notwithstanding the fact that the last Baltic pagans accepted Christianity in 1386, 3 centuries before Old Tisza's trial, the Deutsche descendants of the Teutonic Knights continued to justify their dominant position by regarding and describing the indigenous population as having converted only in the most superficial and the most easily reversible of fashion. I'm quoting Doniker here now. The non-German peasants were commonly depicted as primitive, unworthy, superstitious folk. In particular, their Christian conviction was regularly doubted. Both Protestant and Catholic observers agreed that many Estonians and Latvians continued to worship pagan gods, even though they had been officially converted to Christianity. They were particularly notorious for their willingness to enter into pacts with the devil and for the magic abilities they received from such an unholy alliance. Producing a steady stream of undeutsche defendants whom they could successfully prosecute as witches and werewolves permitted the elite to understand and to represent themselves as continuing the noble but interminable work of advancing civilization, morality, and the true faith, thereby legitimating their position and their power. Institutions of church and state collaborated in providing a moral character to the discriminatory contrast of Deutsche and Undeutsche by recoding that opposition in religious terms. That is to say, it was not a conflict of elite versus subaltern, but a conflict of true Christians against semi-pagans. And in that form, sacred business and deeply justified. Witch and werewolf trials thus served as a primary theater in which this recoding was renewed and rendered credible year after year. But after the Swedish king issued a royal decree in 1686 barring the use of torture in these trials, this is 5 years before Tisza comes on trial, it became much, much harder to get confessions. And without confessions, it became hard to convict. And without the ability to convict, it became hard to maintain the narrative that this was the true faith, maintaining itself against the danger of these ignorant pagans. Having already once been acquitted, Tisza faced the court of Venden with a good deal more confidence than most of his predecessors. If such things were sins, I'm quoting him now, if such things were sins, would not the judges before whom he previously appeared, who were as wise as the present ones and who understood such things well, wouldn't they have informed him of this and not smiled at it? What is more, the outcome of that earlier trial had been much discussed in this vicinity. As Judge Akerstaff of the Venden Court observed, quote, after the old man's acquittal, he was idolized by the peasants. The defense Tisza mounted constitutes an exceptionally revealing example of a resistance that is simultaneously religious, legal, cultural, and political. Thus, After accepting the court's charge of werewolfery, he went on to dispute the judges on virtually all key terms constitutive of the charge. Most prominently, their constructions of hell, devil, and werewolf. For example, the hell of the court's theologically informed and conventional imaginary was a realm antithetical to God, the church, morality, faith, good Christians, and the hope of salvation. Any contact with hell of this sort was prima facie evidence that a person was infected with sin and posed a serious danger to others. The judges articulated this understanding most fully. Oh dear, we didn't. No, we'll look at this. When they rebuked Thies as follows, and this is from the transcript, he broke the oath he had sworn to his Savior, Christ, as part of his holy baptism, in which he had renounced the devil, all his creatures and works. Having forgotten God's way, he committed other highly forbidden sins of similar sort, consistently turning to abomination and scandal, not to God's house, where he formerly could come to knowledge and service of God through preaching and Christian instruction. Instead, he preferred to run to hell. Here, Thies is portrayed as not just a sinner, but a backsliding reprobate. Having received care, instruction, and sacraments from a kind and generous church, he abandoned what's referred here to as God's house, so he could resume his old ways, which the authorities define as sinful, and describe through the metaphor of running to hell. They did hold out hope, however, that the old man might avoid eternal torment if only he would accept their construction of morality, admit his errors and ignorance, acknowledge their authority and superior understanding, and thereby reaffirm not just the proper moral order of the cosmos, but the socio-political order of Livonia. The old man, as you might expect, declined to cooperate. I put the question to him. Was it not his intention before his death to convert to God, to let himself be instructed regarding his nature and will, to renounce such devilish excesses, to repent his sins, thereby save his soul from eternal damnation and the pains of hell? Answer. Hereupon, he would not answer properly. He said, "Who knows where his soul would remain? He was now very old. What more could he grasp of such things?" In significant measure, Thies' understanding of hell differed from the court's. Evil it was, to be sure, but its evil extended only to the subject, only to the owner of the realm of hell, his guests and servants. And this was so even though hell could be accessed by certain others. In Thies' view, the fact that werewolves visited hell each year did not mark them as evil, nor did it condemn them to return after death, since they came to hell as enemy invaders and not as residents or guests. Raiding hell was relatively easy, moreover, since it was not distant from their homes, spatially or metaphysically. And here's, you know, where Thies spells out his understanding of the infernal region. How did the witness come to hell, and where is that located? He answers, "The werewolves go thither on foot in wolf form to the place at the end of the lake called Puer Esser, in a swamp below Lemberg, about a half mile from the castle Klingenberg of the Herr Substitute President. There were lordly chambers and commissioned doorkeepers whom the werewolves knocked aside as they wanted to take back some of the seed corn and the grain itself that the sorcerers had brought there. The seed corn was guarded in a special container, the grain in another. Now here's the map again. Whoops. Kaltenbrunn, this is Thies's home. Lemberg is right here. There's a little lake in the south of Lemberg. The judge has his castle right next to it. This is where the entrance to hell lies. 6 kilometers from Thies's home. Not a hard walk. Hell's part of the local topography. And it's particularly close to the judge who had been Thies's employer and who's sitting hearing his case. For hell to be close at hand is consistent with Latvian constructions of the other world. There's much other evidence on this. But to place it in the judge's own backyard is really striking. With that assertion, Thies advances the idea, without saying this directly, I mean, it's incredibly subtle and shrewd, but he's really asserting that the infernal associations of the court were closer, stronger, and more enduring than his own. As he further explained, the entrance to this particular hell is just beneath the earth's surface by the side of the lake. It's hard to find, he said, except for people he describes as, quote, those who belong inside. By that, he means the devil, sorcerers, witches who work for the devil and regularly feast with the devil. But he explicitly excludes werewolves who come there as hostile, aggressive enemies of all that world of evil. Most importantly, perhaps, the hell that Thies describes functions as the storehouse of a great manor whose lord stockpiles all the grain and seed corn that his servants have stolen and brought to him. As for the devil, the judges and pastor construed him as the enemy of God and of all righteous Christians, a force that seeks to corrupt and delude the saints, the faithful. Whoever succumbs to his snares are said to be branded with his mark and enter into a formal pact that leads them to sin and damnation. By deceiving the weak, the ignorant, the gullible, the devil leads them from the religious instruction and moral grounding provided by the church, and in so doing, he robs them of their eternal soul. Thies agreed that the devil was a bad guy, and he agreed that he was a thief of souls, but he understood this very differently than did the judges and the pastor. He nowhere spells out his views in coherent and systematic fashion. But 3 points emerge from his testimony. First, in response to questions about his own ability to heal sick livestock, Thies explained that the devil, acting through his witches, is able to seize the souls of people and animals alike, causing them illness and death. His own healing practices, then, were designed to recover stolen souls, and he employed sacred substances and ritual formulae in order to do that. This comes out in this testimony. The judges ask him, where did he learn to prophesy, since many people came to him and asked him what would happen to them? He couldn't prophesy. No, he was just a horse doctor. And if other sinners had done harm to someone's horses, he counteracted that and removed the sickness from them. Toward that end, he used a few words, only about 3, and he administered bread or salt to them, which he'd blessed with those words. What did he know about the sinners who do harm to horses? They're the same as witches, agents of the devil, who do nothing but evil. What then were the words he used in this way? The sun and moon go over the sea, bring back the soul that the devil brought to hell, and give back the animal life and health that was taken from it. And that helps other animals besides horses. Beyond this testimony, Tease consistently maintained that the devil's servants, the people he called sorcerers and witches, forfeited their souls to the devil. As a result, they carried out thefts ordered by the devil, and they worked on his behalf. And they won the right to banquet with him. And there's a nice passage where he describes the fare at the devil's banquets. They eat lizards, snakes, vermin, and the heads of dead horses and such things. And after death, they become eternally Satan's. These are the only passages where Tease talks about the theft of souls. Most of the time, he's much more interested in other forms of theft, specifically the thefts carried out by sorcerers on behalf of the devil. Oh, I'm sorry. I should be showing you the pictures instead of just the text. No, there's another one. All right. How could the witness say, the court is trying to trip him up here now, that on last St. Lucia's Eve, this is December 13th, the werewolves had already brought back this year's prosperity from hell, which the sorcerers had taken there, since sowing and blossoming time was now just approaching. This is in late April during the trial. And thus nothing could yet be harvested. And he explains, the sorcerers had their own special time, and the devil had already sowed long before. Thereafter, the sorcerers took something from that and brought it to hell, and that was the prosperity the werewolves carried back out of hell. Subsequently, much growth followed from our seed, just as rich fruit was obtained from the trees. That was also taken from hell, as was good fishing. Already since Christmas, there was perfectly verdant grain of all sorts and trees whose growth similarly came from hell. The fact that the devil employs servants, has storerooms filled with surplus produce, gives banquets, and lives in dwellings that are described as herrlich, lordly, all of that identifies him as a noble. And Tease consistently depicted the source of his wealth as theft from the peasantry. In a trial of 1651, another accused werewolf ventured further still, testifying, quote, the evil one appeared to me in person in black German clothing. And in witchcraft trials, depictions of that sort were common. Here, as in Baltic folklore studied most extensively by Udo Valk, quote, images of demonic evil acquired a concrete embodiment in the figure of the German landlord. While the authorities aligned werewolves with sin, damnation, hell, and the devil, Tease systematically disarticulated them from that set and repositioned werewolves in opposition to all evils, including also sorcerers and witches. In his account, the struggle of werewolves against malevolent forces found its most salient expression in competition over livestock, produce, prosperity, and fertility, in which every year saw a three-act drama. Initially, all those goods were the rightful possessions of the peasant community, being the material manifestation of the blessed prosperity they obtained by God's grace and their own labor. Each winter, sorcerers stole that wealth and carried it under the earth's surface, doing so on behalf of the devil, who is described as the greatest thief of them all. Finally, in the last act, werewolves raid the devil's storeroom, battle his servants, and take back the stolen goods. In doing so, they are not thieves, but agents of restorative justice, returning property, blessings, profits, and the means of production to their rightful owners. Most often, Tiese described the material side of this battle in agricultural terms. But he also acknowledged that werewolves did steal animals. These admissions usually came in response to hostile questions posed by the judges, who focused on livestock, the most valuable of the goods involved here, more than grain. And this is consistent with the stereotype in the literature that I cited at the outset and many other such texts that cast werewolves as cattle rustlers. The following exchange is particularly revealing. Question: when you were transformed into wolves, why didn't you eat meat raw the way wolves do? Answer: that wasn't the way. Rather, they eat it like men, roasted. Question: how could they be animals with hands if, according to his testimony, they had wolf's heads and paws? With what could they hold knives, prepare the food, or use other tools to accomplish their work? Answer: they used no knives. They tore pieces off with their teeth, and with their paws, they stuck the pieces onto spits they found. And when they consumed the meat, they'd already turned back into men, but they made no use of bread. They took salt with them from the farms as they departed. Both parties in this exchange implicitly theorize werewolf as mediating the categorical divide between human and animal, but they do that in markedly different fashion. Thus, the judges want to maximize the bestiality of the werewolf by imagining they eat meat raw and run on all fours. In response, Tiese parries that as best he can, and not without some humor and some contradiction. He thus describes how the werewolves employ technology, fire and spits, to roast their meat, how they season it with salt, how they use their paws as hands, and how they slip back into human form over the course of their meal. A sharp contrast exists thus between the werewolf of the court's imaginary and that of Tiese's narration. The court sees the werewolf as a savage beast, ensnared by the devil, lost in sin, driven to commit brutal violence against lesser creatures as a means to satisfy his rapacious and insatiable appetites. In Tiese's description, the werewolf is a fierce and courageous champion of justice, committed to recovering the abundance that rightfully belongs to the peasants, which greedy lords and their thieving lackeys regularly steal from them. Here, as elsewhere, werewolves proper are not at issue. Werewolves in this exchange, and for both parties, figure as a trope for the situation of undeutsche Livonians resisting domination, exploitation, and disparagement at the hands of the deutsche elite. Court officials spoke the interests and perspective of the elite, and they did so in thinly veiled fashion. By constructing werewolves as extreme but instructive examples of the paganism, aggression, and bestial violence present as a potential in all of the undeutsche peasantry. The latter group, like subalterns everywhere, had to be more guarded in their attempt to invert that set of signs and to turn it to their advantage. Only once in the transcript does Thies explicitly say anything about the elite. The passage is brief and also ambiguous, but all the more fascinating for it. Question. Weren't there women and maidens among the werewolves? Also, were Germans, Deutsche, found among them? Women were certainly among the werewolves, but maidens were not. Rather, they were of use to the flying sprites or dragons and were sent out to take away the yield of milk and butter. The Deutsche don't join their company. Rather, they've got a special hell of their own. Neither of the issues, women or Germans, was pursued any further. The court drops those questions and moves in other directions. And the question of the Germans here figures almost as an afterthought. It's a side issue that we touch on delicately and don't probe. Apparently, the judges were satisfied with Thies's statement that the Deutsche had a special hell of their own, and they saw no need to pursue that issue. But we have to ask what exactly the old man meant. Did he mean to suggest that the Deutsche raid a special hell that stands apart from the one visited by their undeutsche inferiors? That's possible, but it would contrast with testimony Thies gives elsewhere about Russian werewolves who go to the same hell as do the undeutsche, and there's sometimes fights between them there. Alternatively, did he mean to imply that there's a special hell that the Deutsche don't raid, but one that they own and inhabit, that they have it in a proprietary sense? Both those interpretations are possible. To me, it seems likely that Thies framed his response so that different fractions in his audience could hear what they wanted to, dependent on their interests, and that it's a very skillful exploitation of the ambiguity. There is a slight tilt, though, to the latter interpretation, since he never uses the verb to have when he describes the undeutsche werewolves. When he's describing their relation to the hell that they visit or raid. They don't have a hell, they visit, they raid, they go there. To have a hell seems to imply a proprietary connection. And to the extent that the ambiguity is unstable, I think he's saying something very, very nasty about the Germans. Close analysis of Thies's trial permits us to recognize, a sharp struggle between the Deutsche elite and the undeutsche peasantry. And it's a struggle for control over werewolf discourse. We can understand, moreover, that such skirmishes are not just reflections of, but real and powerful interventions in the larger struggle over the maldistribution of wealth, power, prestige, dignity, and justice. Effectively, Thies fought to appropriate and rework a tendentious item of discourse through which the Deutsche elite demeaned and devalued the undeutsche peasantry. Most of the peasantry accepted the term and that usage, and their standard maneuver is to deny that the term applied to them. Oh yes, werewolves are terrible. I'm not one. I hate the werewolves as much as you do. That's the standard peasant reaction. Yes, bad, but not me. In contrast, Thies accepts that description and affirms that he's a werewolf. And having done so, he attempts to redefine its meaning by inverting its moral valence. I'm a werewolf, but we werewolves are good, he says. We fight the forces of evil, and we secure our people's welfare. Certain implications in his testimony make an even bolder case, moving beyond the defensive position of resistance to something that approaches insurrection at the level of the symbolic and the discursive. For one can hear him saying, albeit sotto voce, when he talks about hell being near the judge's estate and Germans having a hell of their own and banqueting and the Herrlich nature of hell, you can hear him saying, we're not the ones in league with the devil. That honor, my worthies, belongs to you. As the trial wore on, the judges realized they were making no headway with Thies, at which point they called in other witnesses to incriminate him. These included a peasant named Gurion, who it had been established, received service from Thies. Thies healed his cattle, and he protected them from wolves, and he also blessed Gurion's grain. And Gurion admitted all that under questioning, and at that point, the court had what it wanted. We move to the verdict in the trial. Both the royal court and the Herr Pastor of this place, Magister Buchholz, earnestly and movingly reproached Gurion, as well as Thies, with their grievous sins, devilish temptations, superstitions, and idolatry. As Thies still would not understand, it was necessary for Gurion, who was himself not the subject of evil rumors, to state that he was given to sorcery, standing in the presence of the judges and all assembled, especially in front of all the assembled peasants, regarding their delusion that some holiness was in these things. So Gurion is made to confess. On the contrary, nothing could be decreed with regard to Thies. So all was in confusion. In the end, Gurion cast one bundle after another, and these are the salt and other magic materials he'd gotten from Thies. He threw them with his own hand into a fire that had been laid. Following the Herr Pastor's proclamation of the true God concerning his gracious mercy and forgiveness of the sins he had committed, also telling him henceforth to change and to abstain from the things that were previously highly forbidden, in order to avoid temporal and eternal punishments, he did this with fear and trembling, and thereby openly atoned for the acknowledged public scandal. At the following Sunday's preaching, he was obliged to stand at the church post, and as sacred conclusion, I would stress that, sacred conclusion, he was legally condemned to be struck with 12 pairs of blows by the high executioner. The Herr Pastor also emphasized for the whole community the strong and cruel punishment of such a person for his guilt, and he admonished each one of them to desist from such things. The denouement is as extraordinary as the trial. Unable to overcome, indeed, perhaps unable to comprehend Thies's skillful, determined, and eminently principled resistance, the agents of state and church turned their attention to the much less culpable, but much less resourceful, much less courageous, Gurion Stepp. Better schooled than Thies in the conventional relations of domination and submission, Gurion assumed the role of the ignorant peasant and repentant sinner that the court demanded and Thies refused. As such, he permitted the authorities to maintain their faith in the legitimacy of their power, which they exercised on behalf of God and against the devil. And when his punishment was carried out, at the most sacred and most public of times and places, the conclusion of Sunday service, at the door to the church, poor Gurion became an object lesson for all the other undeutsche peasants of how they ought to behave and what they might expect. One would like to imagine that things ended differently for old Thies. And they did, but only in minor ways. However heroic resistance may be, in most cases, it enjoys only limited success, chipping away at the forces of oppression, slowing the advance of superior power, obstructing for a moment the operation of infernal machinery. Thies was given another chance to confess, and he refused once more, pleading, somewhat contradictorily, that many others had done the same thing, but in fact, he was old and remembered little. Having failed to obtain a confession, the Venden court brought in no verdict. Rather, they held Thies in custody while his case was reviewed by superior courts. And on October 10, 1692, a full year and a half after the first trial, the Royal High Court pronounced him guilty, noting that he had confessed to being a werewolf, stolen cattle, visited hell, and led others into superstition. Like Gurion, he was sentenced to public flogging, 20 blows instead of 12. And this was explicitly said not just to be, quote, a well-deserved punishment, unquote, but it was also to serve as an example, or in the parlance of the court, quote, to change him into an object of noteworthy aversion that might warn others against the same vexatious and punishable conduct and warn them to let superstitions flow away from them themselves and be banished for eternity, unquote. Clearly, the vexatious and punishable conduct to which the court referred was not limited to werewolfery, but involved the much more serious offense of resistance. Thanks for your attention. If there's anything here you'd like to talk about, I'm delighted to do so.